Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
And welcome, Dr. Dawn Motika, to our monthly visit.
Well, I'm happy to be here, and thanks for your kind invitation to show up at a sort of rotating mid-month time, middle of most months, on one of your lovely Wednesdays, to answer medical questions and also to be ready to talk to people about, well, some of the issues around healthcare that aren't strictly speaking scientific, maybe a little bit of political, maybe some questions about how on earth am I going to navigate this and what on earth is going to happen. Things have certainly been thrown into a bit of a tizzy.
So you can tell us about how what's going to happen with Obamacare. Do you have a feeling or any inside knowledge of where we're going to go with this?
Well, the inside knowledge really comes from taking a look at what the options are for Obamacare or people who want to get rid of Obamacare. Because Obamacare is not this monolithic piece of legislation. It's actually, because of the very complex and convoluted rules of our government, there's some things that could be done with the touch of a pen on Inauguration Day. And one of those things, and some things that could be done with a 50% majority in the Senate, and some things that would require a supermajority, that's 60%, which they don't have. And so the question becomes, we've made this commitment that we're going to dismantle it, but actually dismantling something that's up and running can break more than the thing you're trying to dismantle. So here's an example of where I think there's going to be a lot of pushback from a surprising quarter, and that's the insurance companies. Now, you don't necessarily think of the insurance companies as loving Obamacare, although they've actually made record profits in the 3 years since Obamacare was promoted and actually started. So the insurance company is doing great on Obamacare, and they're raising their rates, and the rest of us are suffering. Remind me to talk about EPOs in a minute, but I'll make this one short. You can, with the touch of a very easily defund, you can defund these subsidies. So people who are, I use the example of a guy making $30,000 a year. That person has health insurance. They're probably getting an $800 a month subsidy for their health insurance. And so their out-of-pocket cost maybe is $100 a year. They have, and if they were to lose that subsidy, suddenly their cost would be, let's call it $1,000 a year, $1,000 a month. And they would say, I can't afford $1,000 a month. I'm not sick right now. I'm just going to let it drop and take my chances and hope that I don't, need more than $12,000 worth of health care this year, but I'm going to save myself $12,000. On the other hand, if you're that same guy and you happen to have skin cancer and you're under treatment for melanoma, you're going to find $1,000. You're going to find it somewhere and borrow it even to keep that health insurance, because otherwise your cost is much, much higher. See the dilemma. So from the insurance company's standpoint, anyone who's healthy or thinks they're healthy, once the subsidies are gone, is going to exit in droves. And the whole concept of insurance is that healthy people who don't need health care are paying into a pool, and those that get sick take out of the pool. But if only people who are planning on taking out of the pool are in the pool in the first place, then it's going to really interfere with those corporate profits.
Yeah, and that seems like to me that that's not what medicine should be all about. It's the corporate profits. It should be about the health of the people of the country. And how does what we're doing compare with some of the health plans in the European countries?
Oh, it's a joke. What we're doing is insane. There's just simply no word for it. Every single step of the way, We do things in a non-humanitarian, adversarial approach. The doctor and the patient are enemies. The insurance company and the doctor are enemies. The pharmaceutical company and the insurance companies are enemies. And everyone is fighting each other. That is no way to run a healthcare system. Adversarial versus a cooperative approach in an activity that by its very definition requires cooperation is quite simply insane. And we've gotten ourselves into this mess. And really the only way that we can get out of it is, well, number one, we need to trash the insurance companies completely. There's simply no way that we can continue to send any portion of our healthcare dollar to pay for people to push paper unnecessarily. The next thing we need is comprehensive tort reform. If the doctors don't have to spend 15 minutes charting in order to A, get paid, and B, make sure they don't get sued, it's amazing what you get in terms of medical records. I've been watching this wonderful, cute little television show from the BBC called Doc Martin about a doctor in Cornwall. And nobody who's not a doctor would notice this. But his nurse comes in and she gives him the patient's chart. The patient's chart is a little envelope the size of a folded in half 8x11 paper. And it's an envelope. And in that, there are cards that are like 4x6 inches. And he will make a one-line notation on the card, date, probably vital signs, diagnosis, treatment, and he's done. Puts the thing away and it's next patient, please. He spends all his time seeing the patient. He spends no time charting. And, well, that's TV. But 5 years ago, I was in Spain and we needed a healthcare visit. And we went to a fee-for-service medical clinic because we weren't able to use the national healthcare system. And the doctor took my husband's pulse, took his blood pressure, wrote one line in a ledger, and gave him the prescription he needed. Now, that's not something, that's something that trusts the doctor to actually know what he or she is doing, make a good faith diagnosis, and provide a good faith treatment, and then not have to worry about defending that 5 years later because someone is coming after you in court. So we spend so much money charting, and then the electronic medical records have slowed that process down and made it more elaborate and difficult. So, and we don't get any benefit from that because they don't talk to each other. And so,
who doesn't talk to each other?
None of the medical records talk to each other. So if you come from Kaiser to, let's say, Palo Alto Medical Foundation or vice versa, they don't send each other medical records that are electronic that can be read into a database so that you start your next healthcare up and running with all your records in a format that the doctor can actually see, like your medication list, your allergies, your problems. All of those actually have to, they are outputted in a format that's basically a printed out PDF file. And then Kaiser or PAMP gets, somebody at Kaiser or PAMP gets to transcribe your allergies, opportunity for mistake, transcribe your meds, oops, another opportunity for mistake. And so you introduce all of this human error and completely kind of torpedo the advantages of an electronic medical record, which should be once that information is in there electronically, you don't have to re-input it again when the person changes doctors or goes out or changes states or anything. And the fact that 30 years after it was feasible to have an electronic medical system, record system, we have got this turkey is, I'm going to use that word again, insane. It's just insane. So I'll stop, Grant. I'll stop.
Well, let me ask you one more question. I was in Europe also, and a person I was with fell off a bike and hurt themselves. And we were in Amsterdam. And so we went to a doctor, to an emergency clinic, and they took care of you immediately. And it was, and they had all, and I saw other people, they had a card, like a credit card that they swipe.
Yeah, exactly. So,
let's take a call here. You're on the air with Dr. Don.
Thank you. I'm Nick Charles.
Hi, Nick.
In the bring up subject, the word of the millennium to me is now blood-brain barrier. And to me, that means our better senses are blocking something out. And yet today, this week, I heard that they can now intrude the blood-brain barrier with ultrasound. Mm-hmm. So to me, they saturate me with something, and then on some protest, they hit me with an ultrasound, and my genetics will just be. Can you will you explain on the air of what the genetics and the functions of blood-brain barrier and all the knowledge behind it?
Okay. Well, I wasn't sure whether you were speaking metaphorically about propaganda, which, of course, is a different topic. But the blood-brain barrier is actually a physical is sort of metaphorical structure. Cells stick together, and they can have little pores between the walls of the cells that allow things to pass. And if you want the cells not to allow things to pass, you create these things called tight junctions. So imagine lots of Velcro holding patches of, like patchwork quilt, except every patch is held together by big sheets of big strips of Velcro. And if you want to disturb that, and nothing can get through the Velcro. If I've got that quilt and I drop a dime on it, the dime's not going to get through. On the other hand, if I take my fingers and pull the pieces of Velcro apart on each of, say, a half dozen of those patches, and now I drop a dime on it and bounce it a few times, that dime might get through one of the holes that I've created between the strips of Velcro. You still with me?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So when you hit the blood-brain barrier, which is this basically just the cells in the brain where you've got your CSF, your cerebrospinal fluid. Well, the CSF and the blood vessels that go to the brain have this special barrier, extra Velcro, if you will. When you hit it with ultrasound, it's like I took my hands and pulled all those bits of Velcro apart in my patchwork quilt. So now, for a few minutes at least, that's opened up, and you can blow. Let's see, if I gave a big infusion into an artery, I could maybe get some chemotherapy into the brain. And that would, if I was going to do that every day, you know, the ultrasound and the chemo into the brain would work a lot better than having to do a spinal tap on the person and put the chemo into the cerebral spinal system through a spinal tap, and a lot better tolerated. So, you know, that's primarily where people are trying to use this at this point, is in fighting brain cancer. But the concept that you can use ultrasound to break up these tight junctions doesn't just apply to the brain. It's actually a very established concept in dermatology. And people use, in fact, I have a little ultrasound device that I use for my face cream that just breaks open the tight junctions on my face for a couple of seconds so that my face cream can penetrate more deeply. And it works, because I did a little demonstration project on myself and faded out some of those brown spots that you get on your face as you get above 50. And I faded one out completely when I used the ultrasound, and I couldn't fade a different one without the ultrasound. See, I'm a scientist, and I experiment on myself.
I kind of think a genetic memory can be intruded upon. What do you talk, when you say propaganda, because I can alert it to a devious action?
When I say propaganda, I'm going to use a metaphor for what I just talked about, and I'm going to say that right now we have lost our common sense barrier and because of the internet, because of the speed with which things get liked and transmitted and spread, and before you know it, everybody's saying it, and then tomorrow it turns out not to be true at all. But meanwhile, it's gotten into everybody's head. So the internet has acted like ultrasound, and it's destroyed our BS barrier. Because we used to have a nice brain BS barrier that was called the news cycle. And so things would come up, but they would, you know, Walter Cronkite would go investigate them. And by the time the next morning rolled around and it ended up on the news, it had already been debunked. But now, by the time an hour's gone by, everybody's liked it on Twitter and it's gotten into people's heads. And for the most part, the debunking never gets distributed. It doesn't go viral. And so you have all of these lies and all of these falsehoods and all of these misinterpretations now that turn out a day later to be false. But the fact that they're false never gets into anybody's head. So that's my metaphor. And you know, we're going to not talk about genetic memory because I think that's too complex a topic for this. So thank you very much for the call.
Debunking. I think they've come up with a scientific name for all of that that you were just talking about. It's called trumping somebody.
Well,
lying to them, giving them false news, false reports. You've been trumped. I wanted to ask you, and I mentioned it beforehand, they say it's cold season. And that's usually in winter. Why is winter cold season? Because the coldness doesn't give you a cold.
We always wondered about that. And about 5 years ago, it was established that it has to do with the speed of viral replication. And so the viruses have to breed. and invade you before your immune system is able to fight them off. And they use a lot of different mechanisms. So in the winter, a couple of things happen, but the most important thing is that the temperature is below 80 degrees pretty much all the time. Viruses don't divide well when they are in their initial replication phase after they've invaded the surface cells in your nose. They don't divide well above 80 degrees. And so if you're breathing 80-degree air, the viruses become attenuated and they're not capable of penetrating into the nasal mucosa as quickly. And then once they get in there, they have to start dividing really quickly and make a whole bunch of copies and break open that cell so that they – I mean, that's the original going viral, is that one cell makes a million copies. Each one of those million copies then infects another cell, which makes a million copies. And before you know it – you've got, you know, billions of copies and you're sick.
And so the winter, when it's colder, that's when they can do
it. They can do
work.
It.
Ah, so
and
it does make
people
sense.
Keep the windows closed so the concentrations are higher. And there's various other things about dwell time on surfaces for the viruses that also they do better in the winter.
When you say dwell time, you mean like living time on
the how long can a virus remain contagious if it's sitting in a warm room versus a cold room? And apparently it's the desiccation in the heat.
And so these cold medications that we get, what are they doing for us? Anything? Or
mostly symptom control.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there's some data that echinacea increases your T-cell motility. So echinacea might actually make your T-cells run to the site of the invasion a little bit faster. And so when people ask me, what can I take to prevent a cold, I generally tell them either a mushroom complex, because that definitely speeds up the T cells, or echinacea. And in general, the best thing you can do to avoid getting sick is hand washing. But if you have to take care of a sick child or something, it doesn't hurt to also use a mitogen, which is the term for something that activates T cells. So echinacea is probably not a bad idea.
All right. And you said to ask you about EPOs a moment ago.
Oh, yes, EPOs. Back to the health plan, something I just discovered today. And this is sort of sending an alert out to people who are of the age where you have commercial insurance. Almost all of the major insurance players in town are not offering PPO insurance this year in 2017. And you need to know what an EPO is, okay?
Yeah, because and a PPO too.
Well, a preferred provider organization means that there's two rates. If you go to a doctor who's signed up with them to accept a discount, that's a preferred provider. You don't have as big a copay. If you go to somebody who's not participating and is not a preferred provider, you might be out an extra $30 on the office visit. That's a PPO. Now, if you're in an HMO, that's a health maintenance organization, you're out the entire visit if you go out of network. You can only see a doctor who's in the network, and you can't see a specialist until your designated primary care doctor, or whoever's subbing for him or her, says you can. So you can't go straight to a specialist. Even if you know that I need to see a dermatologist, you can't go see the dermatologist. You have to go to your primary, who has to say, yeah, you need to see a dermatologist. So,
and that'll be $30 or
that'll be $30 for the primary to have come in for me to say that, plus another $30 when you go to the designated specialist, if you can find one in town, because you may have to go out of network for the specialist because there aren't any in-network specialists. So that's a problem right there. But in HMO, you basically have to see people in network and you may have to travel pretty far to do it. Now, a PPO is an HMO in sheep's clothing. It's an exclusive provider organization. So you can't go to a specialist who's not participating. You can only go to people who are participating. So for our area, that might mean, let's say you need back surgery. You might be traveling to Cupertino because that's the first neurosurgeon that takes your insurance. And if you need back surgery, you're probably suffering from considerable pain, and the drive to Cupertino is a substantial inconvenience. But that would be what you would have to do to jump through the hoops for your insurance company. And when I talk about the adversarial process, the whole reason they're doing this is to leverage a discount. So the exclusive provider thing is trying to entice people. No one wants to sign up with these plans. here in our local area. So they're trying to say to people, look, we'll give you exclusive access. You'll get a lot of new patient signups if you sign up as an exclusive exclusive provider, and you'll cut out the competition. And the problem with this logic is, you know, when your reimbursements are at your overhead, you can't make it up on volume. So it will fail. But in the meantime, a whole lot of patients are going to find themselves with extra bills they weren't anticipating, because they'll go back to their cardiologist or they'll go back to their dermatologist who isn't one of the providers, and they'll see that doctor. They're in the middle of a series of care visits, and then they'll get a bill because the insurance company won't reimburse because they're not. So that'll happen. And if people don't understand what they're buying, I consider that a bait and switch tactic. So I've always disapproved of EPOs. I'm still trying to study what the implications are for my business. I see a lot of patients who come to see me because of my medical knowledge in functional medicine. And I might order lab tests or even prescribe a pharmaceutical for them. I'm not entirely sure that if they're in an EPO system, that's going to be paid for. I have to investigate that. I could leave them holding the bag, even though I'm out of the system. My patients aren't all out of the system. So this new wrinkle in the never-ending dirty tricks bag that the insurance companies seem to come up with and are allowed to come up with every year, it's just mind-boggling. And don't forget, these people are making, you know, the CEOs of these groups are driving around in Learjets and making, you know, $25 million a year. And they're sticking it to the guy making $25,000 a year with these ridiculous plans and all of these gotchas. And it's being, and our government, who is supposed to be protecting us, isn't. And is not likely to be in the current climate.
So. Is that because of the insurance companies not wanting to have a one-payer system? That seems to make so much sense to me, to just have one person paying the bills and you don't have to care what three-letter initials are after.
We don't need insurance companies. They know that. They deeply fear what happens to their business model when we finally figure that out politically.
Yeah. Well, we didn't this time.
No,
we're not going to get that this time. Are we going to be able to hold on to any kind of decent medical insurance?
No.
So we're back to square one again.
No, we're worse than than square one, because there's been a huge tax on the system responding to all of the requirements that the new legislation change equals cost, and providers are getting exhausted. And people are just throwing in the towel and they're going to work for somebody else. So it'll be big business against big business. And as long as you have a standard issue illness, you'll be okay. But if you have anything complicated or out of the line, or you have unusual psychological needs or comorbidities.
What was that?
Comorbidities means you got three or four things going on at once, and the treatment for one makes B worse.
Oh, okay. That's a good word. I learned something again every time Dr. Don comes in. You're on the air with Dr. Don.
Good evening. Hi, John. It's Denise.
Oh, hi, Denise.
I'm concerned about forced vaccinations in California for kids that they can't go to school.
Right.
So insurance pays for this, and the CDC says it's okay, but if you're one of those unfortunate kids that it doesn't work out for, and you have all kinds of reactions that could be out side of whatever, who pays for that?
Well, if you can establish that it's an adverse vaccination event, there is a fund that's supposed to indemnify people for the costs associated with an adverse reaction. The problem is it's an adversarial fund, and they treat it like a lawsuit, which means you have to have very good evidence that the problem that happened was a result of the vaccine. So I believe that a lot of people who have genuine adverse reactions don't receive the compensation that was actually intended. With respect to the forced vaccination law, which basically says if we're going to pay for your education, you need to be vaccinated unless your doctor can document a specific reaction to a specific vaccine. So what that would mean is that you might be able to get exempted for measles, mumps, rubella, but you wouldn't be exempted for for polio because you didn't have a bad reaction to polio. You just had a bad reaction to measles, mumps, rubella. And they statutorily, legally, these vaccines are distinct. And even though they actually contain similar components, and some vaccine reactions are, in fact, the majority of them are probably reactions to these adjuvants and other components like the preservatives. You know, we can talk about whether or not mercury causes autism, but for the sake of my sanity, let's not go there tonight. but nevertheless, I think that we have a really adversarial approach to what is an education problem, which is how to give vaccinations sensibly and safely to our children. And instead of, you know, actually seriously exploring that, there's this attempt to say, well, yeah, you know, a few people will get sick, but mostly the parents who say their kids got sick from vaccines are crazy, and we're just not going to listen to them. And if you decide someone's crazy, you aren't going to listen to them, then it doesn't matter what they say after that. And I think that's where we're at. We've gotten, like in so many things in this country, so polarized, and there's no sensible people in the middle talking. There's a bunch of people on either side yelling at each other across the great divide. And, you know, I don't know how.
I just thank my lucky stars that my son is old enough that all I had to do was just sign a waiver because I don't want him to, period. I don't have to say anything. And now, oh, my God, my heart goes out to so many. Anyway, all our sanity. The worst. And California, Governor Brown, thank you. I mean,
I know.
What was he on that day when he signed that?
I think he was under pressure, but I'm not quite, I don't think he was on anything.
Well, he should have been. Maybe it would have been different. Anyway, thank you.
All right, Denise, thanks for the call. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Yes, about the controversy between the people who support vaccinations in toto and those who have been, I guess, labeled anti-vax. I've been following this on social media for a couple years. I do agree with Dr. Don that there has to be a middle. But I also feel that the middle has been pushed over to not the 50-yard line where it should be, but you're already on the 70-yard line when you think you're in the middle because we are so brainwashed about healthcare in this country and alternatives to allopathic medicine. So having said that, I would like to say, I think it's, and I'd like to get Dr. Don's opinion, it's time for people on social media or in and or private conversations for the pro-vax people, like the ones that wanted to push the law for all California children to be vaccinated, they have to stop calling people who question Big Pharma and its result. They have to stop calling them anti-science because that just shuts down the debate. And that's what they do on social media. I see it all the time. Anytime someone even questions any kind of pharmaceutical medicine, they are called anti-science. You get you have this fantasy in their heads of the stupid commoners.
Okay, I'm gonna interrupt because I want to respond to what you said about the labeling, and try to really actually model the behavior that I think gets us out of this, rather than just, you know, I understand you're frustrated and you want to rant, but again, that's a self-indulgence that we cannot afford. The left can't afford to rant. The right, the far right, or well, the far right and the far left will probably never get together, but those are the outliers. The people who think they might be within spitting distance of the middle need to have some new rules of engagement. And rule number one is you are not allowed to rant at all. You get to be an American Indian. You never say anything if it's not positive. You shut up. And you may have a stony silence while the other person rants, but they'll run out of steam, and that's what you let them do. So number one is you don't participate in rants. Number two is you don't accept other people's language. And language is extremely powerful. I don't know when this happened, but sometime in the last 6 months, civil rights became identity politics. And I'm like, no, I liked civil rights better. I thought that was a more accurate description of what the issue was. And so you've got, and feminism became a bad word. What was that, 20 years ago? And,
Rush Limbaugh.
Right.
Feminazis.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you don't accept the characterization. You don't accept the characterization that liberal is a bad thing. You have to fight the relabeling and decide what you want to be called and then use that language. But you cannot afford to let other people change the language on you. That's, we all need to agree on what we're going to call things, and we stand, those of us in the middle, need to get together on social media. And I think this is something that Twitter or one of these other things could probably help with, which is come up with some agreed upon words to describe certain debates and the sides of certain debates. And then we're going to use that language. And then we're actually going to talk about facts. We're going to try to decide what the actual facts are. We're going to look at data. And we're going to recreate the center and pull. And because it's going to be sensible and quiet and civil, a whole bunch of people who have checked out are going to check back in because it's going to be, oh, that's an interesting dialogue. I mean, I've checked out of the news because I don't want to hear what outrageous thing candidate Trump or President Trump says. But I want to go check back into the group of people who are saying, all right, how do we manage our society? We have big decisions we need to make. We have big priorities, and we need to be discussing that. And we need a democratic forum in the middle of social media for people to actually think and discuss their good ideas rather than just rant and polarize. So I think we can build that. I'm not quite sure what it looks like. I think it's some sort of bulletin board or discussion group that is, what do you call it, when someone is there curating it. And if you have to register, and if you start acting up and turning into a troll, you're out on your butt and you don't get back in. So we need, and that's, I think, the way we would have to do it. So thank you for bringing up the issue.
Okay, you're welcome.
This is very cool. It's about prostate cancer. And the way we currently treat prostate cancer, once a man has had if he's had surgery or radiation, we take away his testosterone because prostate cancer cells actually need testosterone to grab on, or DHT, but testosterone to grab on to the testosterone receptor. And that goes to the nucleus and it turns on the DNA for replicating that prostate cancer cell. And if you block testosterone from being made, the prostate cancer cells divide much more slowly or not at all. And that works for about 7 to 10 years, and then it stops working, and the cancers start to go crazy again and divide quickly. And we've seen this. And the latest therapy is, okay, we're going to double down, block testosterone even more, take it away from the adrenal glands. And that isn't working very well because the cancer cells evolve and they start making more and more and more testosterone receptors. So they effectively amplify the little tiny bit of testosterone that's squeaking through. They amplify its effect by building a ton of receptors on their cell surface. So this has been the end of our therapy, and the person dies of prostate cancer. Someone got the bright idea of saying, well, if they've got all of those testosterone receptors, that's like having the gain on a mic turn on your headphones turned way up, and then something really loud comes on. What happens if we give a big blast of testosterone to people? Totally counterintuitive. But if you take these people with prostate cancer and you give them a big blast, like 400 milligram shot of depot testosterone, you kill all the cancer cells, or many, many of them. You don't kill them all, I wish. But you cause the tumor to shrink, you increase the survival enormously, and these are people who have metastatic cancer, so it's growing in their bones. And so this new therapy, which is called burst androgen therapy, you give people a massive dose of testosterone, and then you take it away. And then you give them another massive dose of testosterone and you take it away. And this is now in preliminary human studies beating all of the cancer therapies that we have for late stage metastatic prostate cancer. And I love the fact that it's like we're poisoning the cell with the thing that fed it. And we are trying to stay ahead of this adaptation. I think that if we stop and think of cancer, just the way we think of bacteria, the cancer cells become resistant. But rather than just saying, okay, we're going to switch to a different drug and let it get resistant to that, learning more about the physiology, the psychology of the enemy, if you will, and understanding its vulnerabilities and going after those vulnerabilities in new and very creative and low toxicity ways. So I'm very excited to share this with you.
This is brand new research?
This is brand new research. Let's see, this article was published in Science Translational Medicine in January of 2015, and it was the very first study. They only had 16 subjects, and now this is actually being done as regular therapy. So I consider that brand new.
If you went to a doctor here in town, you could get that done? Or do you have to go to over the hill?
Oh, no, you could absolutely get that done. This is, I don't know, I presume that the oncologists are aware of it and are, in fact, starting to do it.
Well, let's hope so. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Hi, I was wondering, Dr. Don, if you could give us a little bit of your perspective about the rampant prevalence of digestive disorders happening kind of with everybody I know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is either related to digestion of food or bowels or bloating or really just the whole tract. So I'm going to hang up and let you answer that so I can listen to it on my radio.
All right, thanks for calling.
Great question, thank you. Okay, well, I think that, first of all, it's absolutely true. There is epidemic, rampant digestive disorders that are not lethal. They aren't.
They feel like it, Dr. Don.
I know. They make you uncomfortable, but we're not seeing rapid weight loss. We're not seeing people, show up with severe malnutrition or any of the things that would actually make the CDC or the powers that be sit up and take notice. It just makes people miserable, and there's no way to measure misery. So I have several fairly strongly held opinions, and part of it I would blame changes in the food supply, but most of it I actually want to put at the door of behavior changes on our part. And one of the chief behavior changes is that people have they eat very differently than they did 20 years ago. The foods that they eat are largely prepared for them by somebody else, often in a sort of industrial setting. And even if you are trying to cook for yourself, you may be buying sauces or ingredients that you put into your dishes where you're inadvertently putting food additives that shift the microbiome. I recently talked on a different program about maltodextrin, but I'll allude to it here. Maltodextrin is a compound that is found in all sorts of health foods, all sorts of sauces. Any time you get a potato chip or there are those vegetable chips that are root vegetables that are supposed to be all healthy. But when you look at the ingredients, this is in there, and it has an effect on the microbiome. So that those bacteria eat what we eat. And when we eat something that favors a bad bacteria or changes that bacteria from a neutral to a bad actor, then we've shifted the microbiome in an adverse way. And the other thing we're doing with that rapidly provided food that's very, very bad is we're eating it quickly while we're doing something else. So it is an extremely important thing to eat slowly, chew your food, actually be aware that you're eating while you do it. That'll help you. If we chewed our food better, we'd have less dyspepsia. If we actually smelled and looked at the food and had a chance to let our mouths water a little bit before we started eating it and we weren't so distracted, then our digestive system would work better because our brain has to get the signal that food is coming and send a signal to our stomach to get it ready to start digesting it. And if we are so distracted that our brain is looking at our cell phone or looking at TV, and God help it if you're looking at something negative or emotionally activating, because adrenaline turns off digestion. So if you walk into a meal and you're upset or uptight or in a hurry, you've automatically guaranteed that your digestion will be less efficient. You're going to make less stomach acid. You're going to have more chance for heartburn. You're going to have a sort of leaden, heavy feeling in your stomach because the food's not going to be exiting your stomach appropriately because the machinery isn't getting the signaling that it needs to go on to the next process. It's a little bit like a washing machine in the stomach. It has a wash cycle, and then it has a rinse cycle, and then it has a spin cycle. And if you get those cycles backwards, you get a bloody mess at the end of it. And you have to do the whole thing over.
I love the way you describe things. The spin cycle, that's great.
But when you get down to the small intestine, where you're supposed to be absorbing the food, if you haven't broken it down properly because it's unchewed and there's no acid, well, then you aren't going to get the right signaling, and you're going to start to get bacteria growing in the small intestine. When that happens, you start getting lots of gas and bloating. And so that's the second phase of maldigestion. So the first phase is the first symptom is heartburn for phase one, and that sort of leaden, nothing's leaving my stomach sensation. The second stage is you get down to the duodenum and there's bacteria down there and they ferment it. So you eat some bread and suddenly you need to loosen your waistband on your pants because your belly pooched out. That's a sign of that second kind of maldigestion. And then while you're doing that, you may or may not be able to actually break down the fats or the sugars. And if they hit the lower intestine, well, then you're going to get a bloom. And you may get diarrhea, you may get constipation, and you may get depression, and you may get inflammation, because there are vast quantities of bacteria sending signals in your gut. And if you're constipated and you're not pooping regularly, some of those bacteria die, they break up. The toxins in that bacteria are actually capable of getting into your bloodstream and activating your immune system. So you feel toxic, you feel like you're almost sort of poisoned. And that's another, people come in with all of these complaints. And they can all basically be part of this cascade of the wrong food with the wrong additives, eaten with the wrong attitude.
Wow. You know, when you were describing this, this is exactly what I'm going through and have been for about a month. And I am a slow eater, and when I'm always the last one done at a table full of people. So, in my case, what would you suggest?
Extra acid or digestive bitters, because, and also definitely enter into the meal in a relaxed state. You might not want to listen to the news while you're eating.
That's it. It started right about election time.
There you go. See, but you see, if you're in a fight or flight mode, you're not going to digest well.
Right.
So you have to calm yourself down before you eat. You want, and digestive bitters or betaine hydrochloride. Some people will drink a quarter cup of apple cider vinegar before they eat. You want to get the acid levels up. So try one of those three things. So
apple
cider vinegar, a quarter cup. You can buy hydrochloric acid in capsules at the health food store. Take about four or five of those with a meal. Or
hydrochloric acid?
Your stomach produces the equivalent of 30 of these capsules when it's working. Your stomach is designed to resist hydrochloric acid. So your stomach will be just fine. But these extra stomach acids will stimulate the washing cycle. And it will actually stimulate the rinse cycle as well, get stuff into the duodenum. And once it hits the duodenum will stimulate the pancreas to release the digestive enzymes, and then you'll start actually breaking down your food.
Spin cycle.
Well, yeah, spin cycle.
Okay. Less than 10 minutes left here at KZSC, 459-4036. If you'd like to talk to Dr. Dawn this week, she'll be back here in January. I believe it's on, the 18th of January. She will be here with us from 7 to 8 o'clock. So, mark that on your calendar. If you can't get to the phone today, you can do that next month. But right now, a couple of moments left, 459-4036.
One more food additive besides the maltodextrin. I want to talk about emulsifiers. You buy salad dressing. You notice how it stays blended and mixed. It's got emulsifiers in there. Some of them are seaweed, like carrageenan. That's why when you walk on the shore, you see those bubbles. And they sit there, even though there's no soap being dumped into the bay, but there's natural saponification agents, soaps or emulsifiers, and those are things that blend oil and water. So that's great, but when you put a lot of emulsifiers in foodstuffs, it breaks down your protective stomach mucus. So that's part of the problem with the gluten. That's one of the reasons that we're getting so much gluten sensitivity, which is documented. But gluten is a very, it's a protein that's itchy. It's kind of like cat hair. If you've got allergies, you'll get allergies to cats eventually if you live in a house with cats. And gluten's a very antigenic food. So when you have emulsifiers plus gluten in the diet, you literally melt the protective mucus. And if there's any kind of irritation in the stomach, maybe you took an ibuprofen or maybe you take an aspirin every day for prevention of heart disease, then you've got an opportunity for that gluten antigen for you to start making antibodies, to become immunized against your food. And then, oh my God, gluten is everywhere. And then you're immunized against something that you have a hard time avoiding. Let's go to that next call.
Okay. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Hi. So I was calling to ask her opinion about osteoarthritis, and if you think that the joint replacement surgeries that seem to be the only solution sometimes, or is there a potential alternative on the horizon with something that wouldn't involve a prosthesis being, you know, your bones being cut and
right, you know, exactly
being put in there.
All right. It depends on the individual clinical situation, a question like this. So on the horizon thing, for knees, there's some good knee resurfacing things that are in phase two trials, which means that they're pretty much ready for prime time. We can put cartilage. We figured out how to grow cartilage. The trouble was we were growing it in a lumpy fashion. Recently, people have figured out how to build a scaffolding like a pad. And you put that pad in there, and then you drill holes through it into the bone marrow, and the stem cells come up from the bone marrow and start making cartilage, and they grow along that pad, and they actually produce a pretty decent surface. And we're close. So for knee, if I was able to exercise or swim, and I was able to, and I was, you know, in my independence, I'd probably be doing steroid injections, fish oil, cherry juice, curcumin, you know, a kind of combination of things, and trying to eke that one out. Obviously, if you're suffering terribly and you aren't able to exercise, the hit on your health is so great from that, that you probably can't just wait for the knee resurfacing to come along. But if you've got a few miles left on that knee, and it's a matter of changing, wearing flats, and being careful about how long you walk, then yeah, I would wait. Hip is another story. I mean, a lot of hip replacements are done because people break their hip. But if you take those away and just look at the ones that are done for hip arthritis, I think hip replacement really is the best thing we have for that particular problem. And again, the criteria are activities of daily living, ability to exercise, and absolute amount of suffering. And suffering's really weird. One person's horrible suffering is another person's, I can take this. And it's a mystery. I've been doctoring for over 25 years, and the range of reaction that people have, and it's true, they're not lying, is just very mysterious to me. Which joint in particular, or which type of arthritis were you concerned with?
It's hip, and I feel relatively young. I'm not that young. I'm 54, but I have the femur's never been located in the right spot, so I wore it out quickly.
Right, right. You had congenital hip dysplasia.
Really, really super active, and I just can't bear weight.
Yeah,
and it is really painful.
Yeah, I think you're kind of stuck. You weren't born with normal anatomy, and so you used up, and that's not your fault, but this is a very common defect, actually, as birth defects go, and the problem with it is we don't always spot it because it's inside on the bones, and you don't necessarily spot it on the kids, even if you're careful, and, you know, we always do those hip evaluations and make the babies cry. We're doing them to try to spot this in case people didn't understand what that was about, and if you miss it, well, then the person starts showing up in their 30s with hip arthritis, and by 54, they've burnt through all their rubber. So the thing that you will want to think about carefully and work with your orthopedist with is you're going to live long enough to need a second hip, and because your implant's lifetime is maybe 15 years, and you're 54. So at 69, you'll probably still be in, you know, reasonably good shape for a surgery. well, then you're going to need another one. So when you, it's kind of like when you do a surgery and you know that the person's going to need another hip replacement later, there are some technical things you do a bit differently. You use a smaller, you might use a smaller implant, take more of a chance of it slipping, but preserve more bone, for example. So those are just technical things. We may be at a point where we are growing cloned bone into something the shape of a hip joint. Cartilage is a tough nut to crack, but bone is much easier. So I think we could I don't really know if we're going to be able to grow an artificial joint by the time you need one for your second replacement. So work with somebody who does second hips. Go find somebody who does redos and go for your first hip to a doctor who does second hips, because he or she will know what he or she doesn't want to see for the second hip.
All right. Hey, thank you for your call. We really appreciate hearing from you and to call everybody who called in. Very interesting questions tonight.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.